This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5.07, oh, excuse me, it's 5.08. And you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Sharad and Cam. And where we do the countdown to the biggest story of the day. So first up,
number 5.
A historic building is collapsing in the very heart of old Kuala Lumpur. Yesterday, a tour guide spotted damage to part of the ceiling of the former Federated Malay States Survey Department building. A picture she took showed the collapsed ceiling as well as broken wood strewn all over the floors. This is the latest report of damage since one of the dome spires collapsed in 2016.
The building was designed by Arthur Denison Hubbock and built in 1910. It's now considered a heritage site under the National Heritage Act of 2005, is managed by the Tourism, Arts and Culture Ministry, with Kuala Lumpur City Hall taking care of its appearance.
Now, despite the building's recognition back when the spire collapsed, the then Tourism and Culture Minister, Dato Sri Nazri Aziz, said his ministry lacked the funds needed for its restoration. So, what did they do? They applied for $150 million worth of conservation grants from the Treasury. Unfortunately, they didn't receive any.
And Minister Nazri hoped to use the funds to transform the building into offices for Kuala Lumpur Craft Complex staff, who are originally located in Jalan Conle. Unfortunately, the funds didn't materialise and the building has deteriorated further.
Now, this raises the perennial question of which buildings the government chooses to refurbish and why the former Federated Malay States Survey Department building hasn't been considered a worthy investment. For that, we reached out to Associate Professor Keith Tan from the School of Architecture at Taylor's University for comment.
The issue surrounding the FMS Survey Department building, unfortunately, is not an isolated issue. The truth of the matter is that the majority of the most significant heritage buildings in the country are indeed government-owned, or at least to government-linked corporations, or in the case of heritage schools, under the purview of the Ministry of Education. Apart from schools, many of the colonial-era heritage buildings are no longer required for their original purpose, and yet are too significant for demolition. What does this mean? The first stage, unfortunately, is often abandonment, sometimes with a plan for renewal, sometimes without. Unlike in the case of privately owned buildings, the heritage buildings owned by the government do not have to turn a profit. So even those turned into museums, for example, the telecoms building in Bukit Nanas, which is now a museum, just have to remain open for the public to visit. But this is a lot better than demolition.
So Keith also touches on the potential solutions for these buildings.
When a high-profile building like the FMS Survey Department or the Karkosa Srinagara building in the Botanical Gardens is allowed to slowly decay, however, it puts a negative spotlight on this ad hoc model of conservation. What we need is a holistic model that covers all our urban centres, perhaps driven by a more income-generating motive, so that our heritage doesn't just pay for itself, but also adds value to our cities. So it's all about planning. I think the proposed Urban Redevelopment Act is a good starting point, but we have yet to hear the details.
That was Associate Professor Keith Tan from the School of Architecture at Taylor's University, speaking about the abandoned heritage buildings in the centre of historic Kuala Lumpur. And Cam, I know that you actually have in the past done tours, walking tours of that part of KL.
Yes, I take people on occasional tours and for the last few years, and it's the centre of Kuala Lumpur. It's the historical heart. It's the place that people put on postcards or send postcards. It's the place that people come to look at and photograph. And yet we actually allow them really publicly to be collapsing and deteriorating right in front of our eyes. It's I hate to compare things to Singapore, folks. I really do.
but you will.
Sadly, I'm going to have to, because at least, you know, in Singapore, they understand that all buildings of that vintage are worth saving simply for the sake of aesthetics. And just you need that look.
In fact, it's more than that. I guess it's a perfect place to house the new kind of services and eating experiences that people
Absolutely.
Want.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, people come to Kuala Lumpur not to look at ghastly, you know, concrete and glass clad buildings that they can get, you know, in plenty back home.
And then that spare building. Well, let's just I don't know. What shall we do? I don't. A museum. I mean, you have to come up with ideas for it. But we have a lot of buildings, say the railway station, which is just a matter of time before the domes start collapsing on that. So we're really in danger of losing these buildings.
Well, if you have any thoughts on what's happening to especially old KL and the heritage buildings there, remember you can call us 7733 2900. You can send us a voice note or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And now, story number...
Number four.
So continuing our countdown to the top story, we have millennials who are apparently the top renters.
So real estate technology group Juai IQI reported that millennials make up 37.8% of property rentals. Gen Zs are in second place at 30.7%.
Now, baby boomers account for only 2.7% of renters, but they're also the generation that pays the highest in terms of rent. Clearly, they're earning enough. The average amount that this group pays apparently exceeds more than 2,000 ringgit per month, and they prefer renting landed houses to apartments.
More Gen Zs are renting from 2019 to 2024, while other generations have been renting less in those 2 years. We reached out to Chan Ai Cheng, immediate past president of the Malaysian Institute of Estate Agents, to understand the trends in terms of renting, especially among millennials.
Firstly, I must say that the study by Juai IQI is on a very interesting topic. We have always asked the question whether or not the trend moving forward amongst the younger generation is towards renting instead of purchase, and if yes, which group is dominating the renting space? So millennials, who would now be in the age group of 30 to 44, accounts for 37.8% based on the report. So at first glance, right, this is rather surprising numbers, as traditionally most in that age group would have purchased their first home or even multiple properties by the time they are in their 40s. However, the report does not state whether these renters own a home of their own, right? So possibly there is also an increasing trend of millennials renting a home while the property that they own is rented out. So on the matter of the highest rent being the baby boomers, that is definitely due to the fact that they are already on a matured side of life and also well-grounded at the peak of their careers and hence are living in more luxurious and larger properties.
That was Chan Ai Cheng, immediate past president of the Malaysian Institute of Estate Agents. Now, do you have any thoughts, rent or buy? What would you tell young people? What would you tell a millennial if they came up to you and asked you for your advice, if they actually want your advice? Remember, you can call us 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we continue the countdown to the top five at five, BFM 89.9.
Bigotry-free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
It's 5:16. Oh, actually 5:17, and you're listening to the top five at five with Sherrod and Cam, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So, just to a quick recap, we started off with collapsing heritage building in Kuala Lumpur, and then the trend among millennials to rent rather than buy.
Number three.
Five men have been arrested for threatening and provoking McDonald's customers.
This happened last Friday at a McDonald's outlet in Kuantan, Pahang. Apparently, the group approached the man who had been dining in the outlet with his family. They started hurling insults at him. One of them even threatened to beat him up with his motorcycle helmet.
Yeah, so clearly an overzealous group of supporters of the boycott. Now, the group has since... of these three men had been apprehended after the victim made a police report. The case is now being investigated under Section 506 of the Penal Code, which deals with criminal intimidation. It carries a penalty of 2 years jail, a fine, or both if found guilty.
So the group of men were reportedly campaigning to boycott McDonald's in Sungai Isap, which went viral online in a video where they were waving flags. And... and the passenger flag on top of a pickup truck while shouting at customers lining up in the drive-through area.
Now, as you know, McDonald's has become the target of boycott after its franchisee in Israel donated free meals to the Israeli military amid the war on Gaza. We reached out to Nazari Ismail, chairperson of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement in Malaysia, for comment.
In Malaysia, we have clear laws. Even in the aspect of curbing evil, we have to obey the laws of our country. For example, if we see a Muslim entering a gambling shop, we cannot physically assault him. That is taking the laws in our hands, and that is wrong. What we should do is to only explain and advise. It is the same with the issue of boycotting companies involved with Israel. For people who do not want to boycott, we can explain and advise them on the importance of boycotting Israel and boycotting complicit parties. It is certainly wrong to be aggressive or to attack them physically. Doing this will give a very negative perception to the boycott efforts. If we want to convince people with our arguments, we have to do this effort wisely. This is also the advice in the Quran, which asks us to use wisdom in preaching. So abusive and insulting words must be avoided, because that is not a wise way.
That was Nazari Ismail, chairman of the BDS movement in Malaysia, commenting on what I think must be very disturbing for them, right? Because they want to take the moral high ground in dealing with this issue of, you know, the terrible ongoings in Gaza today, you know, done by Israel and also complicit parties, as he calls them. But what happens when the people who are purportedly on your side then go and do things that are damaging for your reputation?
Yes, I mean, the hope with a boycott is that it would last, it should last a fairly short period of time, because the passions can get overinflamed and you get into, well, vigilantism, if that's the right way of saying it.
Indeed. I think the thing about all social movements, right, there'll always be people who want to make use of it for personal gain, or who will see an opportunity to promote themselves. I mean, they're all the people for whom the central objectives of that campaign might not be their personal agenda, right? So they're trying to find a way of promoting themselves or whatever it is. I'm not quite sure what the motivations of these three individuals were. It wasn't in the reports that came out. It did say that one of them actually had a criminal record already. But the very idea that they would be carrying Palestinian flags or slogans to support the people of Palestine and then do something that amounts to potentially criminal intimidation just doesn't work, right? It's sort of like sending the wrong message.
Yeah, but people are not schooled in... People have arrived, I'm going to talk about this later with one of our later stories. People have arrived to the issue of Gaza at this point in their lives, and they weren't thinking too much about it before. So they haven't really thought through the political, the dark side, but also the negative image of what their actions may be. They're simply inflamed passionately by a situation, and the only thing they can think to, well, not the only thing, but one of the few things they can think to do is to boycott, say, McDonald's.
Yeah, but boycotting of McDonald's or any other, you know, alleged complicit companies or countries, you know, is one thing, right? But what happens when you start to think about that your argument is not getting through? Right. When you have failed to persuade people that your boycott of a product or service is justified and they just go ahead and use it. And if you come from a place of righteous anger, what will that end up doing? Right. In terms of your feelings of, you know, frustration. And I wonder if that also might play into what's happening out there in the world.
Yeah. And you're bound to be able to find peers who will support and encourage you and whip you. You'll whip yourselves up into a frenzy together. Of course, it's really similar to a strike in a way. And strikes, when they last weeks, months, into years, it becomes very hard to sustain it with the dispassion perhaps that you had at the beginning. And it looks like your effort has failed, but your belief has become stronger.
Well, tell us what you think about what's happened. You know, this was a odd moment in the BDS movement's campaign locally. Mm-hmm. But do you have thoughts? Do you think this could get worse? How do we scale down or de-escalate this kind of response to what seems to be, in many ways, a morally justifiable campaign? You can call 7733-2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number two.
So we're continuing our countdown to the top story. Basathu wants Perikatan National Field a Malay candidate in the KKB by-elections.
So apparently the party believes that this is what the majority of voters in Kuala Kubaru want. Ulu Selangor Basatu's acting chief, Khairul Azhari Saud, said that the wave of support for Perikatan in the last state election is expected to spread to KKB. But this contradicts an earlier statement from PAS that a Gerak Khan candidate will likely be PN's candidate.
Now, for just for a bit of context, the by-election was triggered after the death of DAP's three-term assembly person, Lee Ki Hyong, in March. Since then, the EC has fixed the nomination day for very soon and polls for May 11th. It's important to note that while Pakatan won the seat, the two other seats in the Hulu Selangor parliamentary constituency went to Perikatan. And this is the wave of support that Bersatu is pointing to.
Selangor Pakatan Harapan has already said that they will field a DAP candidate, which has been held by the party since 2013. But uncertainty remains on the PN side. The question is, what complications might arise if the PN candidate doesn't go for Gerak Khan candidate? And how might a Chinese versus Malay candidate contest between the two major coalitions play out in terms of the tone of the campaign?
Now, we're about to hear from Shazwan Mustafa Kamal, Director of RINs and Partners, weighing in on the deliberations, what Perikatan stands to gain or lose.
I think publicly, at least, there is an expectation for Perikatan National to field a Bersatu candidate or a Malay candidate, just because it would be traditionally playing to their strengths. It's quite known that Perikatan National enjoys or has enjoyed sizable support amongst the Malay majority. What would be an opportunity for the coalition, however, would be to choose a non-Malay candidate or someone from Gerakan to fill that seat, specifically with a specific voter demographic, to test the waters, to see just how much support Perikatan National has garnered in terms of non-Malay votes over the past several months. I think Perikatan National doesn't really have much to lose and can afford to test the waters for the state election.
Now, you also talk about the impact of not going with the Malay candidate, essentially not going with Gerakan.
What happens if they don't choose a Gerakan candidate? It would likely mean a reversion back to status quo. I don't think it would severely impact inter-party relations within the coalition, just because whilst a party like Gerakan can demand or can ask to contest the seat, they're not considered a major coalition partner within the coalition and therefore would not have much bargaining power.
That was Shazwan Mustafa Kamal, Director of RINs and Partners.
So I think both of us, actually, Sharad, have a long connection with KKB. And I've been visiting KKB during their elections, I think mostly federal elections, for the last 15 or so years. And the change has been remarkable. I mean, I remember going there once when it was Adilan. My gosh, it's trying to go back, trying to find remember the names. Adilan candidate. And I remember one of the workers saying, it's now or never. And they lost. And it's never now or never. And I think each time we come to an election, we imagine this is the one, this is the last one. But it's always about an evolution, of a demographic evolution.
Yeah, this is a demographic evolution for sure, I think, Cam. But there's also, and you point to something very interesting, which is that in the heat of the campaign, you're always going to try and tell the voter that, you know, if they don't do this now, if they don't vote for me now, then you're going to be lost. So this seat will be lost forever. But that's not true of democracies. And
hopefully.
Yeah, no, I mean, you see it all over the country, right? I mean, parties win and then parties parties lose, and sometimes parties hold on for a long time. And maybe that's even a disincentive for them to really, you know, service their constituency. And so any party, and especially the incumbent going into this, going to have to think about, you know, what were our strengths? Did we really deliver in terms of the services, or did we just take this community for granted?
And also, I'm wondering, so we're not post-race then. Race is still the determining factor. I mean, KKB is outside of Kuala Lumpur. It's right on the outer edges of KL's gravitational pull. And so Barisan National once controlled KKB, and it looked like they would forever. Nothing would ever change that. And Barisan National is very much a race-based coalition. So race is still a thing, Sharad?
Yeah, well, you know, what is the calculation? The breakdown is 50% Malay, 30% Chinese, 18% Indian, and then others. How that will sort of work itself out in this election, we'll know about the candidates by nomination day, which is April the 27th. And then early voting is May the 7th. And then polling day will be May the 11th. Now, if you have any thoughts about what the parties should think about when they're considering candidates, let us know. You can call 7332900. You can send us a voice note or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bigotry Free Malaysia. BFM 89.9.
It's a 5:38, and this is Top 5 at 5 with me, Sharad, and Cam, and where we bring you the five biggest stories of the day at 5 p.m. Now, just a quick recap. We started off with an abandoned heritage building in the heart of Kuala Lumpur. There was a story about millennial renters. Also about threats made against McDonald's customers from people allegedly or apparently from the BDS movement. And also the question of Perikatan's a candidate for the KKB by-elections. Now, we asked you for, you know, your comments on some of these stories, and we have, in fact, a voice note from Mike. And this has to do with the problems of boycotts.
In regard of the boycotting, I think everyone have the right to call for any boycott as long as it is within the legal rights. But as much as they voice out strongly on boycotting, they must also equally voice out strongly against all the violence that caused by the boycott, like the firebombing from the KK Mart, and now the mob against the McDonald family. So I think there must be some balance in voicing out boycott as well as voicing out against the violence when people do boycotting.
Thanks, Mike, for that. Or Ron P. has sent us a message. Boycotts don't just hurt the subject concerned, but hurts us as much.
Well, not so sure about that one. You know, by the way, Sharad, I was thinking the original first ever boycott was actually successful, where a person called Boycott, Mr. Boycott, was Captain Boycott, was boycotted in Ireland in the 1800s. No one talked to him because he was collecting taxes. Nobody would have any dealings with him. And he eventually, did he kill himself? Or did he left? And it was success. It was
maybe he had suffered a social death.
It was the emotional impact of the boycott was actually really what did it. Not so much the economic impact.
So that's very interesting. And I think Ron points to exactly this thing, right? That, in fact, you know, we're all diminished when we are pushed to a point of where we have to call for a boycott. Though, I like you, Cam, I'm also not entirely sure that boycotts hurt us all equally. And in fact, sometimes they can be a very powerful tool. I remember, you know, in the bad old days of South Africa's apartheid regime, there was a boycott of South Africa, its athletes, its products, in order to pressure South Africa to give up on that, you know, that heinous system of racial segregation. So, yeah, philosophically, I'm for boycotts. We also talked about built heritage, and has this. It's ghastly is a good word to describe the buildings in Kuala Lumpur.
I can't disagree with you. KL is kind of ugly. But we do have some gems hidden amongst the trash. And We need to take care of those, because we need to promote those, and we need to inhabit those and be allowed to enter those. And the buildings around the Padang down in the heart of KL, if we could gosh, I mean, if they're falling apart before our eyes, what does that say to us individually?
And about the government's care and concern about this. I mean, look, you're absolutely right. I think ghastly is a way to describe how we've not cared for this wonderful architectural heritage. It's not just the stuff that comes from, or the buildings that come from the 19th century or the early part of the 20th century, but it's also maybe even the 60s buildings, you know, the brutalist tradition that you see actually.
Some beautiful examples of that. I mean, really world-class, the sort of that stark concrete. Yeah, I mean, really excellent ones.
Yeah, and that really should be supported by the government of the day, I believe. Well, now we're on to the biggest story of the day.
Number one.
So the annual Forbes Top 50 Richest Malaysians list has come out. It came out yesterday. I'm not sure how many people pay attention to this, Cam, but I suspect that it's a window on the state of the Malaysian economy more than anything else. It's not just about who are the rich, but, you know, how do they get rich, that I think is very interesting.
And also just to check, Sharad, surely, if we're on the list or not this year. fingers crossed. Did we make it this year?
DJs on, and DJs and anchors on BFM, are we going to make the list?
You never know.
Okay, I can safely say that I've looked through the list and neither you nor I, Cam, are on the list.
Yes, true.
Okay, but we are going to speak to an economist shortly to discuss what the list means and what kind of window on the Malaysian economy it is. And so, but you can always share your thoughts on this Forbes list. You remember, you can call 7733-2900. You can send a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bigotry Free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
It's 5:45 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with me, Sharad and Cam. We're bringing you the top story of the day. Remember, just a quick recap, we had abandoned buildings, we had millennial renters, we've had boycotts that gone violent, and also the KKB by-elections. Now, the top story of the day, Forbes 50 richest people in Malaysia, and to help us understand the meaning, the deeper meaning of this list, we have with us economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams. Jeffrey, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Hi. How are you?
Very good, Jeffrey. Look, firstly, Forbes releases this list every year, right? I mean, for the general public, we probably just gawk and wonder about the lives of the super rich and we could ever get there. But for you as an economist, what does this list represent to you?
Well, I think economists gawk and wonder about the super rich list.
Do you?
But we also look at it in a different way. And certainly the first thing that I did was not so much to look at the list itself, but to look at the distribution, the diversity of the people on the list, and look at the diversity. First, of course, an obvious way of looking at it is by ethnicity. And then I looked at it in terms of the diversity across the type of industries that they're working in. Where are they making the money and how are they making the money? But it would also be interesting to look at how old the people on the list are. How long did it take them to make their money? And these type of things help us to understand the dynamics of the list rather than just look at it as a, as you say, an annual event. What has changed over time?
And what has changed over time, in your opinion?
Very little, isn't it? I think is the answer to that. Very little has changed over time. But I think when you're looking at wealth and the accumulation of wealth, you wouldn't always expect things to change very quickly, because by its nature, you're building on what you've earned in the past. And this wealth is accumulating over a period of time. But very little appears to have changed. We still see a very high percentage of the people on this list who are Chinese in terms of both number and the net worth. And we're still seeing the same type of concentrations in terms of the activities that they're involved in.
Right.
And that's not going to change very quickly.
Right. Well, I'm glad you felt that it hadn't changed much. It wasn't just me looking at the list. but with the names, so many of the names having been on this list for decades, and I'm wondering, might it be that these are the businessmen who have declared their assets and incomes? And I can't help feeling that there are names missing from the list, and these are perhaps people who have not declared their assets and incomes.
Well, they might be. And we might find out in the High Court what their assets and incomes are, some one way or another. But it might be that. But it also might be that some of the people that we feel are very wealthy because they have a high profile, and they're often in some of the more exciting emergent industries, they're actually not making as much money as people think. And also it might be that they're at an early stage in that wealth accumulation process. So it might be that they're not declaring, but there are some other reasons why some big names aren't appearing.
Now, I want to ask you about Robert Kwok and, you know, the kind of the top top 10, as it were, because Robert Kwok, who turned 100 just recently, has remained there for a very long time. And when we look at the what analysts are saying about the collective wealth of the top 50, it rose by just 2%. I don't know if I'm right to say just 2%, but help us understand, you know, is there a kind of comparative perspective that we can bring to this so that we understand whether this is great news or not so great news?
I think part of the reason why you don't see such a big increase, I mean, a 2% increase, sometimes you might think it would be better for them to put it on a fixed deposit. They would have got more than 2% on a fixed deposit rather than doing all of this investment. I think in the current assessment, there has been a lot of market turbulence. That's the first thing that you need to look at. So you're not, and these guys are not necessarily in the biggest growth sectors. They're not necessarily in the big tech sectors or the big pharma sectors or any of these sort of things. They tend to be in manufacturing, real estate, construction. And these are exactly the industries that over the course of the last couple of years have been struggling. Whereas if they were in other industries, such as, you know, emerging technologies, AI and all of that, you might expect to see their income and then the wealth accumulation rise much more quickly. So it's really, I think, a factor of the industries that they're in, which is also a factor of, you know, the history of their businesses and their age, because many of these are actually, as you mentioned, sort of in the third trimester of their life, like myself. So, but one of the things that we can see, which is interesting, is the biggest portion, if you look at sectors, the biggest proportion, which is about 34% of the net worth and 22% of the total number, is in what is described as diversified industries. And what that means is that they're not actually highly concentrated in a particular product or a particular type of business. And when you have that diversity, it mitigates risk. It particularly mitigates the risk of being expropriated, having your company taken over by somebody else. But what it also means is that you don't necessarily focus on a single industry, and in particular, you don't necessarily focus on a big growth industry. You diversify across a whole range of different industries, some of which do well, some of which do badly, and that means your overall return isn't necessarily optimized.
But you speak of the diversification in terms of how it benefits these billionaires. I'm just wondering, though, in terms of indications, because the diversification is within kind of old faithful, old classics like real estate, finance. What does it say about the country that there seems to be, I don't know, it seems to me a bit of a lack of imagination if it's just building more buildings?
Yes, I mean, but that's where the money is. You see, I mean, if you were to ask, is there a great deal of money in Malaysia in particular, is there a great deal of money in new tech industries, AI and all the rest of it? The answer is no, there isn't. Mm. These companies that are involved in that, and there's a very small number on this list who are involved in actual technologies. It's only 4% of the total people, and it's less than 1% of the net worth. I mean, those people who are focused on technologies are not actually making a great deal of money. The people who are diversified and involving some of their businesses in technology areas are really actually adopting the technology to focus on the consumer market. They're adopting 5G and they're adopting AI and all of this in order to sell it to consumers. So they're actually not in the creation of technology. There's very little research and development. They're not innovators. They're just people who buy the technology from somebody else and sell it into the market. And they don't only do that in Malaysia, of course. Malaysia is actually a relatively small market, only 33 million people. They tend to be diversified not just here in Malaysia, but also around the region and globally. So they're actually focused on bigger markets where they can make more money. And what they're selling into those markets is normally stuff that they're not actually creating themselves by way of innovation through research and development.
Yeah, so interesting that you mentioned this, because one of the biggest gainers of the, this year's list is actually Tan Sri Francis Yeo and his family. Their shares have gone up considerably. Apparently, according to reports anyway, their flagship corporation has partnered with the US tech giant to build an AI infrastructure facility at a data center park in Johor. I mean, do you think that we can go beyond this? I mean, that instead of just being end users of AI, that, you know, the country's economy can be, in fact, generating new products and services and doing the research to get there?
You want my completely honest answer?
Absolutely honest answer.
The answer is a flat no. And the reason that it's a flat no is because there just isn't enough money spent on research and development in Malaysia. It's as simple as that. I mean, a single university in the United Kingdom, where I come from, not even thinking about the Americas, but a single university in the United Kingdom will spend more on research and development than the entire higher education budget in Malaysia. And there is very little connection in Malaysia between the universities and the technology companies. And many of the technology companies here in Malaysia are not generating the innovations because they're not doing the research and development here. They are often partnering, as you've just mentioned, or they are the Asia hub for a European or an American center. And the research and development is happening in Europe, America, Japan, Korea. And then it's being sent here to manufacture, to assemble, and then to sell. And that's the way it's been for a very long time, and it's the way it's going to be into the future, because you need to have long-term investment in research and development. Malaysia just hasn't had that in 60 years since independence. It's just not happening.
So that's some good news then, I suppose.
Well, you can still make money out of that, and that's the issue. I mean, you don't have to be the source of the innovation. It's not necessary. You have to focus on what you're good at. And Malaysia is actually very good at bringing the technology, absorbing the technology, assembling the technology, and selling the technology. That's Malaysia's comparative advantage. Right. It's not necessarily in creating the technology.
Right. So here we are fixating on this list of 50 richest people. But the list is made of a large number of people who have inherited the wealth from their families.
Yeah.
You mentioned you're from Britain. Are there any cultural trends in particular that you've observed when it comes to wealthy Asian families in terms of, say, succession as part of the conversation for the Malaysia super rich?
Well, succession is an issue. Many of these companies, I was just checking through it, at least half of these companies are family-owned companies, so they will be looking at this issue of succession. But it isn't specifically an Asian issue. It's something that we see in many parts of the world. And in fact, it's one of the main characteristics of capitalism, that you have founders of companies that achieve a great deal of wealth, and then that wealth doesn't last more than one or two generations. Some people say it lasts for three generations. It's actually more like it won't even, you know, it'll pass to the children, not to the grandchildren, because the children will already not be interested in the business and will already have spent all of the money before their grandchildren get their hands on it. And that's just a common feature, not just here in Asia, but all around the world. And it is an issue in terms of the sustainability of the companies, because we have to remember that the companies are not just about the founders and the owners and the people at the top. The companies involve all of the workers and everybody and the supply chain, and everybody's associated with the company. So if the company doesn't survive, it's not just the wealthy family that we have to deal with. It's about everybody else in that ecosystem who will be affected by that. And there is a risk here in this list, because, as I say, at least half, probably more than half of the people on this list are in family businesses, and succession is going to be a big issue for them going forward.
Jeffrey, we have about a minute left with you. Many reactions to the list, including envy and dreams of a jet, a personal jet. But the Socialist Party has come out and asked for greater taxes on the rich. What are your thoughts on that?
If you raise taxes on the rich, they'll just take their money somewhere else, and you won't get the money. Taxing the rich doesn't work actually in anywhere close to what we think it might do. Actually, you should have lower tax, because it's the prospect of being wealthy, it's the prospect of benefiting from your enterprise, which is actually at the source of the creativity and the innovation and the growth of businesses. And where you don't have that possibility, then you're going to kill that entrepreneurial spirit. And taxes are one of the biggest and most straightforward ways of killing enterprise in the grave, in the cradle. So no, taxing the rich isn't going to work.
Okay, Jeffrey, this is obviously entree to a larger conversation
about
the need.
We'll come back to this one day, Jeffrey.
We will.
Well, I'm not rich. I'm not rich, so it doesn't matter.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
That was economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams. You're listening to the biggest stories of the day, Top 5 at 5, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.